This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are at episode 4. Wars, so many wars, wars outside, wars inside, cultural wars, science wars, and wars against terrorism, wars against poverty and wars against the poor, wars against ignorance and wars out of ignorance. My question is simple. Should we be at war too? We, the scholars, the intellectuals, is it really our duty to add fresh ruins to the field of ruins? Is it really the task of the humanities to add deconstruction to destruction? More iconoclasm with iconoclasm. What has become of the critical spirit? Has it run out of steam? That is a quote from Bruno Latour that opens the first chapter of our guest's today's book, Dr. Ana Louise Keating, who is a professor of women's studies at Texas Women's University and the author of just a very influential book on my life and my practice and my studies. This book is titled Transformation Now Toward a Post-Oppositional Politics of Change. And in this book, Dr. Keating writes in the traditions of radical U.S. women of color, feminist, womanist thought, and queer studies, inviting us to transform how we think about identity, difference, social justice, and social change, metaphysics, reading, and teaching, through detailed investigations of women of color's theories and writings, indigenous thought, and her own personal and pedagogical experiences. Dr. Keating develops transformative modes of engagement that move through oppositional approaches to embrace interconnectivity as a framework for identity formation, theorizing social change, and the possibility of planetary citizenship. And I am really excited to have Dr. Keating with us today. I think you're going to find this interview really fascinating. I did. And so without further ado, let's meet Dr. Ana Louise Keating. So welcome to the show, Dr. Keating.
Well, it's great to be here.
I really appreciate you taking the time. I'm very excited to have you on the show. When I started the show, I should probably tell you this. When I started the show, I thought about who would be like the dream guest to get going. And you immediately came to mind, and somebody else I'm going to talk about in relation to you, and that is Bruno Latour. So I'm very excited to have you as a guest on The Radical Therapist. And the reason being is because your book has been very, very impactful to me personally and to my work, both as a therapist and as an academic. I'm in a PhD program, and my dissertation's around teaching and learning and family therapy. And your work has just informed the spirit of what I've been doing ever since I discovered it. And I guess I want to start by kind of sharing with you how I don't quite exactly remember how I discovered your book, but I came across, I think it was on Amazon, and I was buying something, and somehow they show up. Well, other people bought this book, and I saw the title, and it said something about toward a post-oppositional politics of change, and then immediately it caught my attention. So for some reason, I just hit buy, and so I bought the book, and I knew I made the right decision when I opened the book, and on the first chapter, you started the book with a quote by Bruno Latour, who I'm also very interested in and has also been very influential in my work. And so I guess I'm curious, my first question would be, why did you decide to start your book with a quote by Bruno Latour?
So first let me just say thank you so much for reading the book and for liking what you see there and then applying it and using it in different ways. I mean, I think that's every writer's dream, right?
Yeah. Sure.
You know, not to just be like sitting isolated on a laptop and just ending right there, you know?
Right.
I really appreciate Latour's work a lot. I think he illustrates one form that post-oppositionality can take. And I love the playfulness in his writing and the way he takes different voices and things like that.
Right.
And, you know, the whole that whole piece that I quote from, it just, I mean, it just kind of illustrates the kind of theorizing that I find to be so productive, because it's not that tired, old, stale oppositionality.
Yes, and you drew from a paper, his Why His Critique Run Out of Steam paper, which mm-hmm. is, I think, a very, very important paper, and everybody listening should read that as well. And but I want to start by talking about the book, and you start the book, Transformation Now, by pointing out how we are all trained to react oppositionally, right? We're trained to mm-hmm. think oppositionally, and especially I'm now close to finishing a PhD program, so I've had a lot of training in academia about thinking oppositionally, and how we build, you mentioned how we build oppositional toolkits, and I guess, do you want to say anything about that, or how these things come to be, or how, you know, we live in a world that we're being trained consistently, especially now, I guess, in, you know, even reading your Facebook feed, right? You know, it's just, it's point counterpoint at this point, right?
Yeah.
And not a lot of dialogue, just a lot of positions being taken.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, that whole oppositional way of thinking is very connected with Cartesian thought, of course, which has just kind of dominated the academy. And actually, I'm like, I used to be a really good, I'm good at like arguing. And I personally, you know, I am oppositional, or I'm really competitive, or I mean, I have those tendencies, maybe because of my upbringing, you know, maybe because, you know, it's like somebody says something like, hey, there's such a thing as a valedictorian, then I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go get that.
Right.
You know, so I have done a lot of that competition, and I have not liked what it does to me. And so there's the competitive hierarchical component, and I think that goes with oppositionality. And then I think just seeing it as a teacher and as a scholar, and, you know, being in settings where, say, my work has been very attacked, or where I've seen students go at each other, then just really thinking about the implications and seeing even physically how it can really, we kind of internalize it, and it can even, you know, at times make us sick. Like I think I talk about happening with the debate around this bridge we call home. So I think that's why I kind of like stumbled across this. What is the alternative to being oppositional?
Yeah, well, you raised the point that this kind of oppositional consciousness has been vital to important social change, right?
Yes.
But you make the case that it's too limited to bring about like long-term change that we're looking for, and it kind of keeps us immersed in conflict. And so I guess you go on to point out, what is bad about oppositional consciousness, right? And I guess I started to think about when I was reading this, even in my own life, how I was seeing activism or kind of some of these things. You really say something I think quite important, and that's how some of these how this oppositional energy tends to turn against itself in some ways, and begins to take down movements and communities and these kinds of things. And I think of like some of, you know, over the last year or two, the toxic Twitter wars of feminism, the Occupy movement kind of crumbling from within, some of these kinds of things that are happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you get that oppositional energy going, you're fighting for social justice, you believe passionately in whatever it is, but it's just very hard to turn off. So instead of the enemy or whatever being this external system, it often ends up becoming the people that you're actually, you know, trying to be in collective with. And for me, I think it's when I saw that, especially right around the year, maybe like 2000, 2001, maybe even a little earlier, when Ansel Dua and I were working on this bridge we call home. And I really thought, you know, here's all these people who, through the internet and through phone conversations, I really had gotten to know a lot of the contributors like pretty well. And they were all like really compassionate, kind people. But when they found out that the book, which they should have known from the call for papers, when they found out that the book was going to have white women in it, They just reacted in these ways that, and even some of the reaction was almost against people who suddenly revealed themselves as white, and then suddenly the reaction really changed. I mean, it was like that way of thinking. It's almost like it could not be turned off, right?
Right.
So this what had been this great online community. And the contributors were kind of like talking amongst themselves. It just kind of like imploded.
Well, and I was thinking, even I'm a practicing therapist, right? And I'm a practicing therapist who wants to work from a position of social justice or attend to social justice. But also my training involved a lot of, critical theory. But what I've noticed now is that when you acquire some of those lenses, and I've had to be really reflective about it myself, is when you acquire some of those lenses, you begin to, it's the only lens you can use, right?
Yeah.
And then I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues that it begins to shut down other, and you allude to this often in the book, but it begins to shut down other kinds of possibilities, ways of looking at things, invitations, those kinds of things, right?
Yes. Yeah, it really does.
Okay. And you also mentioned that it locks us into, and I think this is important, and I'd like maybe you to kind of expand on it. It locks us in, when we take these kinds of oppositional positions, it locks us into these existing systems that we're trying to dismantle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you say something about that? Or?
Well, here's an example of how I think it locks us into the system. First, movements that end up self-defining as anti-racist, right? If you really are getting all your energy from being anti-racist, then in this weird way, how do you move beyond racism if you're anti-racist? You see what I mean? It's like definitionally, the racism suddenly becomes like so important. If that makes sense. I mean, and that's just kind of the superficial part of it. I think at another level, it's like you get locked into this battle. So you're pushing against something, but what you're pushing against ends up in some ways almost defining you.
Right.
Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's really no way out, right?
Right. I mean, because it's like, not only is it like, and I not only is it some kind of identity thing, but more importantly, it ends up becoming a thinking thing. What then become other possibilities? Like, the possibilities themselves become too restricted.
Interesting.
If that makes sense.
Yes. Then you go on, I think, to talk about what you call threshold theorizing. And I want to maybe kind of quote from the book. And you say, thresholds represent complex interconnections among a variety of sometimes contradictory worlds, points crossed by multiple intersecting possibilities, opportunities, and challenges. And you kind of describe it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you kind of describe it as this moving from the betwixt and between to a both and neither nor thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That is kind of these threshold places. Can you maybe describe a little more of what those mean to you, or how you conceptualize those?
The threshold places?
Yes.
The thresholds?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I've been really, really influenced by Victor Turner's concept of the threshold, as he talks about it in terms of ritual. So even though at a literal level, a threshold seems like, the doorway, the limen, here's the inside, here's the outside. If you think of it in terms of a ritual, when you enter that space, you're not inside, you're not outside, but you're in this middle space that itself has a lot of multiplicity, because there's no guarantee how exactly you'll come out of the ritual. So to me, that idea of a threshold ended up being more rich in promise than, say, an intersection, which, too often can be more like two lines crossing. So what I was getting at with the idea of threshold theorizing was that by bringing together multiple theories or perspectives or whatever, the synergistic kind of thing can happen, where transformation can happen, but it can't be completely pinpointed, right?
Right.
So it could be lots of possibilities. And I think that both and, neither nor. I think with that particular thing, I was most influenced by Anzal Dua and a passage in the last prose chapter in Borderlands, mm-hmm. where she's talking about the possibilities, like that idea of being on either side of a river and the possibilities. And she doesn't just, it's not just both and. There's also, there's like multiple possibilities, including going almost like going beyond everything that exists now. So like a neither nor kind of thing.
Right. And which is what you describe as really hard work, right?
Yeah. Yes. It's, I mean, and that's where very closely with the idea of threshold theories, I would bring in Anzal Dua's concept of Napatla.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that Nahuatl word meaning in between space. So again, we get the limen, the liminal. Mm-hmm. But the way Anzal Dua theorizes it, it's that reminder of the pain that so often comes with transformation.
Yeah, and can I read something else? Because I think
sure.
I really love this description. And you describe it as risky, lonely, exhausting work as we live with overlapping, contradictory worldviews, perspectives, and peoples, never entirely inside, always somewhat outside every group or worldview. Nepantaleras do not belong entirely to any single location. Yet this willingness to remain within the thresholds enables Nepantaleras to at least partially break away from the cultural trance and the binary thinking that has locked us into the status quo. I think that's really beautiful, actually.
Thank you. That, yeah, that sounds really good, huh?
Yeah, it really does.
I do multiple revisions. So.
Do you? Oh, yeah. Oh, well, yeah. You nailed that one. So,
thank you.
So, yeah. So it's this living with contradictions and ambiguity, yeah. which it's really hard to do, but I don't think we can move any place without it, right?
It's yeah. It is. It's kind of like the idea of the wounded healer in some ways.
Mm, right. Well, I want to. And you also says you also mentioned intersectionality, and I think in the book you are critical of intersectionality. Actually, you describe it, I'll read something, you describe it, the reference, intersectionality, is used only as a signal rather to actually enact an inclusionary, deeply multicultural approach. And I find that a lot of people are, I'm always interested in language as well. And so, you know, it's being thrown around a lot, but you're the first person, I think, that has kind of critiqued it in some ways. Is that an accurate description?
Well, I think like Jasper Poir has, and I think there's some other people who have. I'm not sure. Like, I've been critical of it for a while, but I would imagine some other people have also. Mm. It's just not really, I don't like. It's not like. I mean, you're not supposed to criticize intersectionality, right?
No. Right.
So, yeah, so there's not a lot of people who are doing it, but I'm at a point now, you know, I've got tenure, I'm a full professor, I've written some other books, so I can say these things.
Yeah.
And I think it's not, I mean, Crenshaw's concept, because she's the one who really introduced it into feminist theory and legal studies, it's a great idea. It's just that, yes, it has become this marker, it's become this code way to talk about race, and then it ends up not doing the work that it's supposed to do, and just, you know, and then visually an intersection just seems a little bit limited to my thinking. Yeah.
So then you reference, I guess it would be important to recognize that what you describe as women of colors theorizing and its influence on you, and in particular, a classic Bridge Called My Back, right? And you describe these lessons learned from that very important book. You call them Bridge Lesson 1, which is making connections through differences, seeking commonalities. Bridge Lesson 2, radical interrelatedness. And Bridge Lesson 3, listening with raw openness. And you describe this as kind of moving beyond intersectionality and actually doing the work. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think, I mean, like, first of all, this Bridge Called My Back itself is often used as a marker, just like intersectionality is used to stand in for race or stand in for women of color. Mm. So this Bridge Called My Back, if you look at lots of you know, not lots and lots, but lots of like articles or feminist theory books, then they'll talk about this is the point when women of color entered feminism. And then they'll like have a footnote. See, for example, this bridge called my back. So it becomes this illustration of a certain, I'd say, inaccurate history of feminism or history of the women's movement. So what I really wanted to do in this chapter was to show how this bridge called my back is theorizing. Not here's an example of women of color, but here's theory. And when we look at this theory and when we think about it, look at these important lessons, you know, that we can then continue to apply. And also, here's a book written by women of color who were feminists in the 1980s. So I also was like really angry with that whole kind of like so-called the wave story of feminism, right?
Where right.
There's the second wave and it's mainly white women. No, no, there's all of this other stuff happening and there's all of this beautiful theory and we need to think of it as theory. And then there's these like remarkable lessons. So I was selective in the pieces I looked at. It's not like I'm looking at every single piece in the book, because there is some stuff in the book, in this bridge, that is like incredibly oppositional. But it seemed to me that even, you know, relatively early in terms of what ends up getting thought of as feminist theory, here's this beautiful, incredibly progressive stuff. So I just really wanted to kind of focus on that and think about what it could teach us.
And your takeaways, I'm really interested in this radical interrelatedness as a Buddhist, right? And I think you've also been influenced in some ways, at least you spoke to it in the book. And would you say a little something about that?
Yes. So, you know, my first book was called Women, like really horrible title, Women Reading, Women Writing, Self-Invention, and Paula Gunn-Allen, Allen, Gloria Anzaldúa, and Audre Lorde. And so these three authors, Paula Gunn-Allen, Allen, Gloria Anzaldúa, and Audre Lorde, were like incredibly important to me. They were like the first like feminist authors that I read. Because I actually, my education was really classical, I guess you could say. I mean, I did my dissertation on Emerson's epistemology. So I really, you know, I really was like, why do I like these three writers so much? Why do I like what they're doing? What are they doing? How are they? Because each of them in various ways does this really great job of like, making connections with lots of differently situated people. And somehow it's just like thinking about all of that, that it just really struck me that like almost like really deep in their work, because it's not like pulled out way on the surface, they have these worldviews, these epistemologies or metaphysics that are really positing like interconnectedness, like really radical, this radical, you know, they're monists, if we think philosophically. There's this one stuff, and call it spirit, call it mind, call it whatever. But they seem to be positing that. And then that actually linked back with Emerson, because, one could argue that Emerson has a metaphysics that does something along those lines, which is, you know, then like, well, okay, so this is really what I believe. So, you know, so I found these writers. I mean, you know, I'm kind of like backing into it all because it wasn't some intentional search. And so they kind of taught me that, wow, this is kind of my worldview, and it can do this really important work, because if you think that everything is interconnected, then that becomes not just an argument for the importance of a kind of reciprocal ethics, but it can kind of teach us about some of the ways we can do that ethics, and it has important implications for, you know, confidence in our own ability to think or to, you know, understand things, because we are connected to these things.
Now, you mentioned this idea of listening with raw openness, and it has me thinking about, you know, as a white male, right? I guess, how do I say this? I'm trying, you know, that a lot of my task is to sit in uncomfortable conversations, right? Because I have the privilege of not having to do that if I don't want to, right? And so I'm wondering if that is similar to what you were thinking about, this listening with raw openness, or how that takes shape in your mind.
Yes. I mean, that listening with raw openness in many ways is a product of the years that I've taught a graduate course in U.S. Women of Color. And in many ways, I designed the course to think about issues of racism and other uncomfortable issues. And the students in the course have always been really diverse, some white, some black, some Chicana, some South Asian, you know, whatever, but really diverse. And it's painful. It can be painful in different ways for each of the people sitting in that room,
right,
as they hear about these other experiences or as they reflect on the ways that they're implicated or accountable. I mean, and if we step back and think about it almost metaphysically, I mean, you know, we, or ontologically, whatever,
yeah,
we're like all, I mean, you know, and this is one of the things I would preface the course with saying, or I would say at the point of these difficult conversations, we are all thrown into this world and the various bodies that we have that we're born with, you know, unless you believe in reincarnation, which in fact I do, you know, and you could say, well, the soul is picking it, but, you know, set that aside because, you know, most of my students don't think that.
Right.
So here we are. And so what do we do? What do we do? What do we do with this? You know, so for people who are hearing what it means to those who aren't, say, white. You know, what does whiteness mean to somebody who's a person of color? How has whiteness functioned? What have white people done?
Hmm.
Then there's this real, you are open to hearing it, and it can kind of peel away some things, so there ends up being this rawness to it.
For sure.
So it is extremely painful. And in some situations, yeah, it's a choice to listen. In other situations, like a classroom, like, you know, everybody was like, they're there in that classroom. It's a required course. They have to be there.
Right.
So then it also kind of ends up functioning. The idea of raw, listening with raw openness functions as an invitation to actually do that.
And how has that got, how's that been in the classroom?
Because I mean,
amongst my colleagues, you know, it's this idea of like when you're teaching multicultural or what have you, cross-cultural classes, that's when your evals come out the worst, right? Because,
yeah,
people, it's just kind of this known, talked about fact that it's, people have a hard time sitting in these difficult conversations.
Yeah. I think that's true. I mean, the course I was teaching was a graduate level course.
Hmm.
So there was, it was a required course, but the students who were in the class had made the decision to get a master's degree in the field in women's studies. So I think that kind of willingness meant that even though maybe there might be one negative evaluation,
yeah,
or two, you know, basically what I would see is there would be certain students after that course who would refuse to work with me.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, they would do their best to like avoid taking other courses with me.
Right.
You know, and that's, you know, that's not as bad as getting a bad evaluation.
Sure.
And the first, I didn't have tenure at first when I was teaching it, but it didn't impact me in the way that it definitely can. And so like at this point, so I developed these presuppositions for classroom dialogue. And a lot of my graduate students use those presuppositions when they teach at the undergraduate level, because setting them in the syllabus,
yeah,
I think can kind of help, especially when these like painful topics like race, when race is historicized and you can really say, just because it's like this now, it didn't always used to be. Hey, let's go back and think about indentured servitude. Hey, let's go back and think about these people before they were called white. I mean, when you can like really open it up and give this huge historical view, that can help in some ways, I think.
And I want to mention, I do have your other book, Teaching Transformation.
Right? Mm.
Yeah. And so, and I want to mention it just for anybody that might be listening that needs some ideas or syllabus help, that kind of thing. It's wonderful for that as well.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And so anyway, and then you kind of, I guess the first bridge lesson, and I'm going to maybe bring in, you kind of take on the possible post-structuralist critique. And that was really interesting for me because I hang around a lot of, and sometimes I would even classify myself as a post-structuralist, or kind of I have an affinity for post-structuralism. And you talk about commonalities, which can, you know, pop some flags for the post-structuralists, right? But you're this idea of making connections through differences, seeking commonalities, and you're really clear to say this isn't about sameness, right?
Right.
But it's something different. Can you say a little something about that?
Yeah. Wait, first tell me. So I actually would kind of, I mean, I would not call myself a postmodernist.
Sure.
But I love, I mean, but a post-structuralist, I mean, I'm not really a label person, but I mean, actually I love post-structuralism. So what is it that post-structuralists don't like about commonalities?
Well, I think when they make the mistake of commonalities and essentialism, right? What does that mean? When you start to talk about womanism and the womanist, and you bring up Judith Butler's critiques of some of those ideas and of past mythology, et cetera.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's kind of connected with that.
Yes, I guess I'm kind of trying to have you maybe cover several territories.
Yeah. So I think and this actually goes back to like listening with raw openness. What I saw happening in the Women of Colors course was somebody would like completely bare their heart. Like we'd be reading Borderlands and somebody who was Chicana, grew up on the border, would just say, I can really relate to this, and would narrate this one experience and would start crying or something like that. And then I would have a well-meaning student, usually a white woman, who would just really be empathizing. And then she'd say, I know exactly what you mean. And then would go on to tell a story that wasn't the same. Right?
Right.
But instead of seeing, oh, there's something similar but something different, and I don't know exactly what you are feeling, but, you know, sameness, this assumption of sameness or complete identification would just kind of like cover over the possibility for difference. And this, I mean a relational difference. I don't mean a difference. Too often we define different as the opposite.
Right.
So it's same or different. So what I'm really trying to figure out and what I'm grappling with is a way to think about how we can acknowledge difference without then spinning it into entirely different in some kind of binary way.
Right.
So for me to think about commonalities, I mean, maybe I need to look at a dictionary or etymology because I haven't. I mean, I think of commonalities as like a web.
Yes.
Or something, so it's loose. So there is room for these differences, even as there's room for like these similarities, or maybe these tiny little points of sameness, but still there's also difference. Does that make sense? It, like, sounds really vague as I'm saying.
Well, no, and it's once again trying to hold the complexity, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and so it makes a lot of sense, but in a world that often, you know, often wants the binary, right? It's kind of hard to do.
Yeah. And you know what? Binaries are a lot easier, right? It's easier to think, oh, it's the same, or, oh, it's dichotomously different. That's easy.
Yes.
But yeah, this commonality is messy.
Yes.
Complexity is messy.
Yes. So that leads me to this question, and correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but I think you took this position of beyond intersectionality, you also kind of take this position of maybe beyond feminism, as the way I'll describe it. And you move into this idea, and I'll read a quote. It's I believe womanism to be radical in its transformational promises, more able to embrace contradictions and ambivalence, and more inclusive in its vision. And you go on to say that feminism makes gender the key focus, womanism does not. And you borrow the idea of womanist from Alice Walker. And would you say a little bit about that? Is that kind of a beyond feminism?
Yeah, you know, I mean, like when I started teaching feminist theory courses, my students and I would really notice that feminism in some way or other either centers gender or insists that gender has to be a component in things. And even though the name womanist would seem to be like foregrounding one very specific kind of gender, womanist theory does not necessarily do that. So to me, womanist theory, especially as Alice Walker does it, especially as Layli Mappayan does it, seems to me to really be broader. So I personally don't use like the label feminist, but I think people often like think of me as a feminist. Ansel Dua and I used to have these discussions. I'd go, I'm not a feminist. And she'd be like, oh, I think you are, you know? So, You know, in a sense, it's that idea that, well, labels just only they take us so far and then that's it. So so for me, and so this kind of womanism that I'm talking about, also I should really distinguish, is not womanist theology that centers on like African American women.
Right.
Because that there is that womanism also, and you know, I really respect that. But I'm actually looking at this much more inclusive kind of womanism.
And you also, you have a quote about your, you question the, like the political effectiveness of rallying around normative concepts of women or mythic monolithic images of the goddess. Is that what you're thinking? Some of the theology that you're talking about?
No, I mean, no, that would be more like some of the cultural feminist stuff that often gets associated with, say, Mary Daly. I would say that the kind of womanism I'm interested in goes beyond Judeo-Christianity in a way that I think sometimes womanist theology doesn't. But, you know, I mean, it's not that one is better than the other at all. I'm just thinking of, like, what I, you know, what I find most useful for, like, constructing my worldview or thinking about theory or teaching or, you know, seeing as really inclusive.
Right. I have to say, you know, a lot of this is, I mean, have you had any pushback or have you, do you find from your own community or?
Well, I mean.
Because I think you're really revolutionary, right? That's why I think it's, and these ideas are, I can see how you might get some pushback, right?
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen like negative reviews of the book, and I haven't like seen people in writing like be critical. And I don't use a lot of labels and stuff like that, like when I'm just talking.
You don't?
No.
Okay.
No, because people just misinterpret the labels, you know? So.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so, I mean, it's actually been a while. I mean, there have been once or twice I've been like set up, like, here, we want you to be at this panel. And then like some of the other papers are kind of like very critical of what I'm doing.
Really?
I didn't know that, but that was a while ago.
Okay.
So, I mean, yeah. So, you know, either I'm oblivious to it or I don't know.
Well, okay. So before I move on, I wanted to ask you about this womanist self-recovery and how you conceptualize that or how you would talk about that.
Yeah, that, you know, I started thinking about womanist self-recovery because, I mean, first of all, I mean, and I guess this actually goes with the fact that I really have enjoyed reading Emerson, who is so often quoted in self-help books. I think self-help books could be really fun to read.
Right.
But I also noticed that there's some books often written by women of color that are doing a kind of self-help that doesn't have that narrowness that, you know, mainstream self-help books so often seem to have, where there's this very kind of like complete emphasis on the individual. So it all, you know, it's all about like how I became wealthy or how I loved myself or, you know, me.
Right.
But it seemed to me that some of these books, and I focus really, I focus on Paula Gonellan and trying to think about what she's doing. But I mean, Louisa Teach, and I mean, there's others also. They're talking about self-health, self-care, self-improvement, you know, if you want to say. But it's always done in this like relational way so that changes in the self also lead to these like larger transformations. This is the way we actually can become social justice activists. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I really like that image, and you really do take on the Western individualist ideal, right?
Yeah, and it's yes. I mean, and again, and this was, you know, and these are like this is the culmination of me like thinking about some of this stuff honestly for years and years because it's not that the individual doesn't matter. It's not that selfhood doesn't matter because here we are in these bodies going around and we look like these individuals and we look like we're autonomous and separate, but that's not all of it, right? So it's not like, you know, so there's these more porous borders and boundaries that we ourselves have. And this idea of self in relation all the time, even though we often are almost taught not to see it.
Yeah, right, right. So you kind of close the book with this pedagogies of invitation, right? And so I guess my overriding question, well, I have a couple of questions, but the first one would be, how do you do post-oppositional in the classroom,
right? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Well, it can be really challenging, particularly in classrooms where there's these overriding social justice issues. Because, racism, bad. Right. I mean, sexism, bad. I mean, it can be these things that just seem so obvious and so glaring. And so of course it's like this. And yet, first of all, what I have found is that if I go into the classroom absolutely convinced of here's what's right, that's what's wrong, here's what I want y'all to learn, my students actually are not going to learn it. I mean, they might, some of them might, but there will be pushback.
Right.
Because it's just, it's like a tree. If there's a tree and it's completely, completely stiff, then if strong winds come, that tree's going to get knocked over. Right. I mean, there has to be this flexibility and this kind of like moving with the wind or changing with the context. And one of the things that I think post-oppositional or invitational pedagogies do is very aware of the context. Here's the context. Here's the course title. Here's the course objectives, in the catalog. Here's the students. How do I think about all of that in the context to how I'm hoping these students will be transformed? And then I think there's this going into it with this idea of education is reciprocal. So it's not just here's what I'm going to teach you, but also what are you going to teach me? How are we learning together?
Right.
So that there can be this openness, because I think a certain kind of openness, I think, is part of being invitational to being surprised by our students. Hmm.
So are you pretty clear about how you're going to talk about things or... how that looks or
what do you mean?
Well, I'm just wondering how are we going to be dialogic or how you set the stage, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually how I do it in my classes is instead of lecturing, I mean, sometimes I do little like here's some information kinds of things, but I use discussion questions. So the students have to come up with questions about the readings. And the questions cannot be yes, no. There can't be that kind of, it can't be like, what, like, do you like this? Or does the author mean this? Or it can't be a question that has a yes or no. It has to be like, what do you think, what happens if we put this and this into this dialogue? Hmm. And then when I arrange my syllabus, I really always try to pick pieces that will talk to each other. Whether it's like talk to each other because they're saying such different things or because they have different perspectives on the same thing or whatever, so that hopefully the material will also kind of be in dialogue with each other. And then I kind of try to set that kind of stuff up in the syllabus.
That's great. Yeah. So I have another question as a teacher, and this is of my own kind of research interest. So what do we do, with post-oppositional, what do we do with epistemology?
What do you mean, what do we do?
Well, I'm thinking of sometimes we get hardened in these kind of I guess I like Ken Gergen calls them walls of containment, like these epistemological walls of containment, and it doesn't create like this creative crosstalk. And I get a sense from your work that you're interested in those blending and thresholds. And I've heard other people, some academics say, well, you can't, especially in therapy, it's there's this movement that you can't move across epistemology, right?
What does that mean? Like to move across the...
Well, I mean, you can't be a postmodernist and a post-positivist at the same time. And,
oh.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, but can you, right?
Or, yeah, you can. Yeah. I mean, that's like, there's that Walt Whitman thing. I contradict myself.
Yes,
very
love
well,
it.
Then I contradict myself. I'm large. I contain multitudes.
Yes.
I think that's where there's a richness. I mean, why not hold a contradiction or why not hold and call it that? This seems like a contradiction. Is there something else going on here?
Right.
I mean, and that's where like a very rich idea of commonalities, because what is in common, not the same, But what is in common between these epistemological systems that seem so different? I mean, that to me is like rich and productive, yeah, and possibly the place where something new can be created.
I agree. And that's kind of what I'm really interested in, and in beginning to have people kind of talk about that, right?
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
So I'm glad you feel that way. So I have another question. So when I'm talking about, and this is a, kind of a more personal question, just kind of as a white male and, you know, at the top of the pyramid, privilege pyramid, right? How, and I start to come in and talk about post-oppositional ways of being, and people are like, well, none of these systems would be dismantled unless there was opposition or these kinds of movements that have taken place. How do I, or my, what would you suggest to me? How do I begin to talk about this in a way, you know, that it's post-oppositional, or try, you know, continue to have these conversations?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not, and I think you've kind of alluded to some of this just in our conversation tonight. I mean, like early on when you were pointing out, like, these oppositional movements have been really, really important. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're still doing productive work. So to say post-oppositional, first of all, as I define it, and let me back up more. Like,
sure.
I thought about calling it non-oppositionality, but ironically, non-oppositional opposes opposition. Right? Not oppositional. So even though there's like so many post this, post that.
Yeah.
For me, what post-oppositional, what I was thinking it could do, I don't know if I really defined it well enough in the book though, is to move through opposition is not the same as rejecting it. So to be to propose a post-oppositional approach, first of all, one can propose a post-oppositional approach to this or to that or to whatever, which is much easier and will get a lot less kickback than saying everything should be post-oppositional right now.
Sure.
Right?
Right.
Because, you know, it shouldn't. I mean, I think opposition, you know, I'm not going to like judge other people who feel it's important to have oppositional practices or to be oppositional in this context or that context. But what I'm going to say is, I'm not sure we can always be oppositional. We need additional strategies that learn from oppositionality and maybe even go beyond it. So like Chela Sandoval's theory of differential consciousness, even though she calls it oppositional consciousness, I think she's like learning from all the different oppositional consciousness, you know, movements and social justice movements, and then proposing another possibility.
Who was that again?
Chela Sandoval.
Okay.
Do you know her?
No, I'm not familiar with her.
Well, she had, I mean, I can like email and
that would be
this.
Awesome.
Yeah, her theory of differential consciousness is just really, really great.
Okay. I would love that. Thank you. Okay. So before I cut you loose, I'm interested in what you have planned and what you're doing. I know you're editing a new journal, right?
I think like this is like so exciting to me. So, you know, I published Transformation Now at the University of Illinois Press. And I really, really, really loved working with them because they got what I was trying to do in this book.
Great.
And they let me have an exclamation point in the title. And, you know, a lot of times like publishers are like really picky about what you can and can't do.
Right.
So they were really cool. So like last summer I approached my editor and I said, I would love to do a book series. I mean, I've wanted to do a book series for a really long time, and I don't even know why, because it's really a lot of work and you don't really get any money.
Right.
But but no, I do know why, because it becomes a way to create new knowledge. So, you know, and I wanted to call the book series Post-Oppositional Studies, but the publisher said, no, that name wouldn't work. I mean, and you know, the marketing people have a lot of say in this, which is why it's called New Visions in Indigenous, Womanist, and Feminist Thought. So it's a book series. So if you know anybody, or if you, you have a book, you know, manuscript that would fit with this, that's post-oppositional. So what this is going to be is a way to continue making the kinds of change that I'm calling for in Transformation Now.
That's great.
I know, and it's a university press. Is that like... I just feel so lucky.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's that. But then I have so my next book project is going to be on womanist spiritual activism.
Oh wow. Okay. And do we have a release date yet, or do you
I don't even have the proposal done.
Okay.
but I hope it will come out like in my series. But it's really, I mean, you know, I think like talking about spirituality, spiritual activism, it's very circular, right? Like, how do you talk about metaphysics without talking about epistemology, without talking about ethics?
Right. And it
kind of wraps around, so it's really challenging.
I'm sure you'll find a way.
and then, I hope so. And then I edited Anzal Dua's final book, quote unquote final, because she has some other stuff. And that's coming out from Duke in October.
Outstanding. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. And I'm going to just let the people listening to the show that I'm going to provide some links for all of the stuff we talked about on the website and the show notes. And I want to just thank you again, Dr. Keating, for spending the time. I know you're busy getting ready for a school year. Have you started yet? Or?
No, we start on Monday.
Okay. Well, good luck with the new year.
Thank you.
And I would love to have you back eventually when you release something from the series or something of your own, or you just want to talk for any reason at all. There's always an open door.
Cool.
I'd love to have you back. So thank you for spending time with us. Thank you for sharing. And thank you for being such an influence on me personally and my work. I just want to thank you. So,
well, thank you, Chris.
Yeah.
And, I'd love to hear, you know, what you do with it and how you develop it and put these different epistemologies in dialogue.
I will, definitely let you know that. So
awesome.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yep.
All right. Bye.
Well, that's it. I hope you enjoyed our show as much as I did. I really recommend you go out and get the book, Transformation Now, Toward a Post-Oppositional Politics of Change. You can get it at Amazon easily. I'll provide a link in our show notes on the website at theradicaltherapist.com. I'll also provide some information of some of the people we talked about during this interview, like Gloria Anzal Dua and some of her work, which was very influential on Dr. Keating. So please go to theradicaltherapist.com to do that. I also need your help. I would really appreciate it if you're enjoying the show to go to iTunes, review the show, write a review, rate us. It's very helpful for us to get in front of other people. If you like what you're hearing here and you think other people need to hear it too, which I do, please go to iTunes, rate and review the show. You can also find us on Instagram at The Radical Therapist. You can find us on Twitter at The Rad Therapist. And that's a way to communicate with us. And if you want to send us a message or an email or have a question for us, you can do that at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. We really appreciate you listening. There's going to be more shows coming at you. We appreciate your support. So just thanks for listening. Again, I'm Chris Hoff, and this has been The Radical Therapist.